Welcome to The Better Build, a podcast exploring the world of software engineering leadership with those who are shaping it. Today's episode is a special one. It's a recording of a recent panel we conducted on artificial intelligence with two industry leaders. What they had to say gives crucial insights into how this rapidly evolving tech is impacting different sectors, what we can be excited about and mindful of, both now and moving forward. Let's get to the episode.
Welcome, everyone. Glad you're able to join us. Super excited to have this conversation today with Prachidai and Naomi Goldapple. I've known both of them for quite some time now, probably 10, 12 years for both. And so maybe we can bring them up on stage just to get going so we can say hi. There you go. Hi, Fred. So we had a really nice intro conversation last week about everything AI and machine learning, data science, and pretty excited. I'm sure we're going to have a good conversation. So really quickly, just quick backgrounds. Naomi is a longtime executive in the data space. She started in the data world, I'd say it was in 2013, Naomi, with Nexology, then joined Element AI. Element, as many people know, was one of the first major AI consultancies in the world, founded by Yoshua Bengio, who's often known as the godfather of artificial intelligence. And then in 2019, she joined AlayaCare to kickstart AlayaCare Labs. For those of you that don't know, AlayaCare is a growth stage startup based out of Canada that helps power home healthcare. I was looking at some information online and it's pretty amazing. I saw a data point that you guys are powering 5 million patient home visits per month, which is pretty awesome. And I'm sure generating a lot of data. And so, like I said, Naomi and I met about 12 years ago. She was a mentor at Founder Fuel, a Montreal-based accelerator where I work. And glad to have you, Naomi. Thanks. I also met Fred at Founder Fuel, where he was a mentor as well. Fred is a longtime serial entrepreneur. We met, I believe, in 2010 or 2011. When he co-founded OhmSignal, one of the first biosensing apparel companies that would push real-time biometrics data to the cloud through a connected shirt, which I bought, which was awesome, and then later a sports bra. After OhmSignal, the IP from OhmSignal was acquired by Honeywell in 2009. Fred continued to work in the AI and data science world for many large companies. He rolled his team into UKG, which is one of the world's largest workforce management SaaS platforms, from what I saw online, doing $4 billion a year in revenue. So pretty amazing company. And Fred was head of AI products there, and so has a lot of great experience to share with us, both from UKG and from previous projects he's worked on. Good. Maybe just to get started, Naomi, can you tell us a little bit about your role at AlayaCare and if I missed anything in terms of your background?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much for inviting me. Really happy to be here. So I run the data intelligence team at AlayaCare. And as Gabriel said, what we really are an ERP platform, so a SaaS platform specifically for the home care space. So that means any home care agency or health authority will use us for everything from intake to scheduling to point of care to billing. And so we are effectively, we're very sticky because it's really everyone, it's a system that a system of record that you run your company off of. But we also become like an EHR, an electronic health record. And this is where we collect all the data for the, as Gabriel said, we're actually closer to 6 million visits per month. Every visit that happens, there's tons of data that's attached to it, right? So there's when did the visit happen? Who was there? What happened during the visit? What were the diagnoses? What were the activities that had to happen during that visit? What is the status? What is all kinds of information? And so with all that information, we work to kind of solve the hardest problems that the industry is going through right now, namely huge labor shortage of home care workers, nurses and home care workers. So we build models to predict who is at risk of churning so that we can mitigate those churns. We also have optimization models for the scheduling and routing so that they can spend more time with visits, less time on the road. And then everything to do with the actual health record. So predicting who is at risk of hospitalization, how do we mitigate that? And of course, lately, using a lot of the large language models to sift through the mounds of nursing notes, progress notes, visit notes that are collected but seldom read and acted on. So this is a very, very exciting area. So basically, I run the R&D part of that, but also the actual data engineering side. So the actual pipelines that are bringing all that data to us.
Amazing. Thanks for the intro. Fred, I'll throw it over to you. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you're working on these days. As mentioned, you were recently at UKG. We were just joking around, besides traveling the entire globe over the last couple of weeks and months. What's keeping you busy?
So nice to meet you all. Started my journey in AI and data about 15 years ago, as Gabriel said, mostly working on predictive algorithms in healthcare and wellness. And that has been a fantastic journey. I then move on, focusing more on industrial manufacturing, logistics, working for a very large company. And the last 2 years, been focusing on the HCM, the human capital management and workforce management space. Obviously, developing all kinds of algorithms around forecasting, scheduling, hiring, performance, etc. I'm actually on a sabbatical right now, but I'm a huge fan of mission. So I'm really happy to be here today to talk to all of you.
Amazing. Thanks, Fred. We appreciate you carving some time out to spend with us and Naomi as well, of course. And so I'm glad we can see everybody at the bottom now, Robin. I was wondering, I was wondering where everyone was. So glad to see some familiar faces. And like Robin said, we want to make this as much of a discussion as possible. And so we'll start with some intro topics. But as Robin mentioned, feel free to throw questions up in the question section on the right side of the venue screen. And we'll leave a good chunk of time towards the end to go over those questions. And so you have two folks here who have been working in ML, data science, AI for almost a decade. And so this is a good opportunity to ask your burning questions. And so, like I said, I'm going to throw a softball over just to start. So first question is, where do we believe we are in the hype cycle and adoption cycle of AI? I know we were talking, there's machine learning, AI, there's separate things, there's consumer side, enterprise side. In general, where in the cycle do you think we are? Naomi, maybe I can throw it to you first.
Yeah, sure. So I think I'll pick one of those categories, and maybe we'll just talk about the generative AI stuff, because that's the latest and what's been the most hyped over the past 18 months, I would say. And when we were discussing this before the panel, I was reflecting on what it looked like kind of 2015, 2016, just when Element AI was being put together. And of course, there was a massive hype happening at that time too, which was because of deep learning. And I think that the hype really becomes a hype, especially when people, like everyday people, can actually start to use it and feel it. So then we started to notice things like, ooh, Facebook, Instagram, they can actually recognize faces. That's kind of cool. I see that Google Translate is so much better than it was before. I can see that my predictive texting and all that is really powerful. So there was a real surge in terms of how we're starting to use AI in our everyday life. But when we started to be, how can we roll this out at an enterprise level for other industries? It was definitely not a slam dunk. So aside from the Googles and the Facebooks and all that, who were able to do it back then, and the AWS, it also took a while, even for those traditional AI, to actually bring these into production. So I would say now some of that traditional AI is definitely in production. I know that we use logistic regression, things that are maybe not as sexy nowadays, but are starting to be more mainstream, but just not really talked about as much. They just become another tool in your tool set. But this unleashing GPT onto, as we say, Monsieur, Madame, tout le monde, so just like to anybody, has really changed the game, because it really empowered people. So anybody felt like, wow, they could sit in front of DALL-E, they could really make magic happen. So it made everything feel really real. I think it also really set the bar really high for people like us who are trying to build solutions that people are expecting really, really good results. So this made everybody crazy about over the past year in terms of like, this is going to change work. It's going to change everything. This is really, really revolutionary. And I would say now we're in the, I don't think we're quite in the trough of disillusionment in terms of your curve, but I think we're definitely on the, everyone is coming down to earth in terms of what can we really do and what can't we do. So I know for us, we had all kinds of ideas on what it can do. And what I found people were getting excited about was how could it basically fix any problem that we have with our current technology? How could it fill gaps for things that our technology doesn't do today? And of course, it can't do all that. What it can do is the things that it does really well. And it does still do those things really well, like summarization, like extracting meaning from text, translation, even conversation can be done well, depending on how deterministic you want it to be. But actually, you know, so I think if we stick to what it does well, then it's great. I think now people are a little bit less in terms of that it's going to completely revolutionize our life. And that Devin, if you heard about the Devin, who was the programmer who was going to come and eliminate the need for any programmers, I think now we all realize that these are going to be really good assistants and great for decision support, and they're going to be getting better, but that it's not going to turn everything upside down as we thought.
Yeah, super relevant example for our audience. Thank you. Okay. Right on your end. I know we talked about this data point that I saw on Bloomberg that was talking about how many times Gen AI was mentioned in board meetings. So in Q4, I think it was the all-time peak where it probably in every board meeting across every public and probably private company in the world, everyone was talking about, like Naomi said, hey, this is the solution for everything. Why aren't you taking advantage of it? Where are you? What is your AI roadmap? And we saw this quarter, the number of mentions around Gen AI reduced by about 50%. And so maybe that's the signal in terms of people starting to realize what's actually possible versus the hype cycle that was really strong last year. And so I know UKG's large private company, was that what you saw as well? Last year, there was a lot of excitement about what was possible. And how are you seeing things today?
Yeah. So, I mean, at UKG, we dive head first into generative AI. For various reasons, because also we really believe that HCM solutions have been stagnant for a while and people were looking for something that was more interactive and a lot easier to use. I mean, if you guys use somebody like Workday, for example, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So the hype was extreme last year. And yes, I think it has slowed down because people have actually played with POC. I had a friend who was a partner at a very large consulting company, I won't name, but one of the big one. And he told me that last year, basically every single one of his clients started a Gen AI project. And after 6 months, half of them stopped because they realized it wouldn't work. And then the other one basically continued to try to actually make it work. So, which was very different than the enthusiasm we had where, oh my God, I can do a POC in 3 days and I'm going to get into production in 3 months. So I think everybody is realizing that and also is more aware of the challenges and the potential exposure. So if you love company launching a conversational AI assistant that actually make up policy, like we heard a large Canadian company do, that's very dangerous. That said, the overall hype, I think, was very interesting for people in the industry because AI went from that thing that the geek in the corner do that I really don't understand, but I need to tell my board I'm doing something about AI just to look trendy to, oh my God, this is going to change the way we work. And it's not today, but it will impact us significantly, especially the combination of generative AI and traditional AI. The way once we actually very familiar on how to both use those together, I think we're going to see some major change down the line. So you've got attention, you've got resources, you've got priorities. It changes the working relationship between the AI team, the product team, and the leadership, at least in the large company that I've talked to. The idea of developing POCs within companies have also changed because you can do those so much faster. The enthusiasm from everybody, we had a hackathon at UKC we organized on Gen AI, and we had over 1,000 people participating in this hackathon on 15,000 people, right? So never had that kind of success in actually having people trying to find solution. I mean, some of it was maybe noise at the end of the day, but just able to bring the whole company toward trying to create innovative solution was fantastic. So I'm glad for the hype. And obviously now we're getting into more realistic mode. But it's important for everyone that's on the call today and that's either part of those team or want to be part of those team. I think it's important that we continue pushing the innovation with generative AI, stay focused, maybe not be disappointed that everything that you wanted to do is not working, but have a more realistic perspective on the technology, but continue, because this technology of generative AI, as well as traditional AI, I think they're only going to get better in the next few years, and companies who can actually master them and use them appropriately in their environment, I think they're going to leapfrog the rest of their competitors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's great feedback. You mentioned POCs or proof of concepts a few times. I think that's something we wanted to talk about. For the folks on the call and who are listening, who are having these conversations with their clients or even thinking about building a personal proof of concept for a project that they're working on or want to get exposed to the new technologies, what are some of the learnings or best practices that people can think about when they're approaching building a POC? And so in your experiences, and we talked last week, it sounds like both of you took that approach of building an MVP, what we call in startup land MVP, versus going into production right away. Naomi, any thoughts around some of the best practices that people should think about when they're thinking about what to build and how to approach building it?
Yeah, sure. And just before I forget, just something that Fred said was he thinks that the technology is just going to get better, like for Gen AI over the next years and so. Mm. And what I find, I feel like it's getting better literally over the weeks. It's so fast. When I think about even when we met last week, whereas GPT was state of the art for anything conversational, now Claude 3 is really better. And you really have to keep on your toes. So one of the things with the POCs is you have to be quite nimble. So if you decide to use maybe your provider's managed service, we are experimenting with AWS Bedrock. So you need to make it easy to be able to swap your models, because they are changing at such a rapid pace, really more rapid than before. In kind of the first wave. Now you can comfortably put in some basic machine learning models and leave it there for the next few years. It's pretty stable. But this stuff is still changing like wildfire. So that's part of it. But I think for us, and specifically because we're in healthcare and home care, I would say home care is like the poor cousin of the healthcare. But ever since the pandemic, home care has definitely been a lot more under the spotlight, because people are afraid to put their loved ones into long-term care and leave them in hospitals because of some of the stuff that happened. And in general, people age and get better, much better in their own homes. So one of the things that we do that works really well for POCs is, even POCs, we call it co-design, is to work very closely with validation partners or design partners. So we're fortunate that we have about 7 customers, and there's always some customers that are always on the bleeding edge and always want to try the newest stuff with you. And this is really, really helpful, because we don't pretend to be clinicians. We definitely have subject matter experts, but here you get to really work with those who are going to be the consumers of your prediction. Because, as we know, a prediction is really just a number, right? Between 0 and 1. And you have to make sure that you don't put things like that into production. If you put this patient has a 0.47 probability of X, that doesn't really mean it's not actionable for a nurse. So you have to convert things into a way that is useful for them. So very, very big. So it's very useful to design out workflows, to design how to communicate the decisions to them so that it's actionable, and making sure that it's very explainable. Because one thing that we've really noticed is, especially in home care, in healthcare, and they should be, they're very suspicious of these models, right? Because we're dealing with people's lives. So they really, really want to understand that black box. And that's why in the POCs, we actually work with very weak and kind of simple models, so that we're able to expose them and earn their trust. If we went directly into a sophisticated deep learning model and they asked us, I don't understand why they moved from a medium risk to a high risk, and we'd look and not sure, just the models are kind of magic. Some correlations happen that we didn't know. And that's not satisfying for them, right? They really, really need to know. So that's been invaluable for us to do that with them. And also, what with the POCs, especially with the conversational generative AI, the world of guardrails right now, like making sure that it's not going to hallucinate, making sure it's going to reach into maybe the RAGs, the retrieval augmented generation, the specific data that you want it to look into, making sure that that's working properly, that it's not giving erroneous answers. That's really not a solved problem yet in generative AI. So we can make it better, but it's really not quite deterministic. So doing these POCs, you can really kind of tweak it. And this is where we're doing a lot of tweaking nowadays. And then I think the other thing is on the actual infrastructure side, because this is, it's an unusual time where your providers are kind of morphing at the same time that you're morphing. So the goalposts are moving on every, on the model side, on the infrastructure side, on the cost side. There's a lot moving at once. So you really have to be able to iterate and kind of isolate what's going on. So for example, if you are dealing with, you're using, let's say, GPT, sometimes like we're noticing that we get throttled, right? So all of a sudden we're not, the latency is just crazy when we're, and we don't know why, right? Because the throttling can happen at different times. So this is where you start to experiment. Well, maybe it's better if we bring some of these models in-house so that we're not at the mercy of these proprietary models that we're waiting for the latency. So there's also ways of how much performance hits do we get for smaller models, but cheaper, and we can control them better. So there's a lot of gauging that you're doing. And this is all has to happen in the POC phase before you decide how you're going to roll this out. So the two takeaways, definitely with validation partners, invaluable, right? To really see how they're going to be adopted. Uh-huh. And then doing the POCs, because there's a lot of moving parts. I think it's great to be able to isolate, kind of fix one thing, and then be able to make good decisions before putting this in at scale, because it can be very costly and you could find that you have really bad latency and hallucinations. You could have all of them all at once and you're not going to have a satisfactory product out there.
Mm-hmm. Fred, you talked about a hackathon that you guys organized at UKG. For the folks that are thinking about figuring out what POC to focus on first, do you have a framework or some insights you can share about, we in product typically use this complexity and impact framework to decide what to build first? Is there something similar, or are there any attributes that are different when you're approaching these types of POCs?
Ideally, we did have a framework at the end, because when we realized how many POCs people wanted to do, but in general, I'm a huge fan of continuous innovation, experimentation, and it's very important for large company because it can get stodgy. And one of the advantages of generative AI is that it really reduces the amount of effort to do a quick POC.
Okay.
Can be a challenge because then you have too many, but it's fantastic. And the other thing that's also great, if you work in a mid-sized company, you can now do POC in AI, which with traditional ML can be very time consuming or expensive. So I love that. And one of the way we use the POC, especially at the top of the high cycle, is to use POC so you can actually understand better how this technology can work for you. They highlight weaknesses. For example, we did a POC in a certain field. I'm not going to go too much into detail, but we realized that the data we thought we had that was great wasn't that great. And so that led that team to actually have a whole data cleaning process that was actually very useful for other parts of the organization. And they hadn't realized that until we started doing a POC and started actually measuring some of the outcomes of the LLMs and realized, oh, I'm wondering when I'm getting this. Ooh, well, it's a data, right? So that's been great. Also, is like, one of the things that most people don't realize when you deploy AI solution is that oftentimes, like maybe 70%, 80% of the work is actually in change management with the people, products, sales, et cetera, but also processes. So doing these POCs quickly and trying them internally also gives you a good idea of how that's going to actually impact your product flow or your process flow and how you need to change. So you can make a decision like, yeah, I could get that product out the door, that model out the door in 3 months, but I actually have 6 months of marketing work, product work, and process work. And that's something that my team cannot do right now. So maybe we'll. So I love the POCs for that, especially in the context of generative AI. If you have too many ideas, And if you have, you don't have the means to do all the POCs that you want, having a framework for impact is great. And I've always been a fan of focusing on areas where you can create competitive differentiation for AI. Most companies don't have a large AI team. UKG was different. We're like 65 people, so end to end, but most companies cannot afford that. So like focus on where you're going to create competitive differentiation versus other products, where you can actually create superior customer engagement, etc. Like don't try to do something, for example, like in customer service that Salesforce or Google is going to actually create, and it's already on their publicized roadmap. You're not going to get a better Salesforce or customer service support engine than some of the large companies out there. That said, if this is something like a real pain point for you, one of the things that we've enjoyed doing is doing quick POCs in those areas to really understand how the technology can actually help us and use that as a framework to make a decision on what vendor to select, right? That was really interesting. So if, for example, in customer service, it's one area where everybody is looking at Gen AI. I mean, we'll say customer service and RAG are really like the two main area where people are pushing right now in large company. And this is thing where even if vendors are actually going to do great product in a year or two, and it's going to work well for you, doing quick POC is going to give you a better feel of, are you process up to date? Are you using content up to date? How are you going to leverage that internally? And so when you do your vendor selection, you actually have much more knowledge.
The Better Build is brought to you by Mission. Mission is an award-winning network of senior-level software engineers and product builders, backed by a platform that helps engineers continue to learn, grow, and connect. To get your team of fully managed, fully remote, and fully flexible software engineers, or to join our community, visit us at mission.dev.
Naomi, on your side, I know you were leading Alaya Labs, which I'm sure had some sort of framework to decide which initiatives to focus on. Any tips that you can share in terms of prioritizing or figuring out what areas to focus?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. We really focused on what are the biggest problems that our industry is dealing with, like what are our customers dealing with? And we said like, okay, labor shortage, what can we do to help there? And then there's a lot of new regulation that's coming in where, especially in the States, where home care visits will only be reimbursed by Medicare if they show. So, sorry, the industry is moving from like transaction-based to value-based. So they don't want to just reimburse you for somebody showing up at someone's house, doing something and leaving. They actually want to show that you're improving outcomes. So how are you actually helping them? And they want to measure you on that. So that makes them very driven to improve their metrics. So they want to show that they have the least amount of, on their watch, the patients fall less, they are hospitalized less ER visits, all kinds of adverse events are less. And therefore, if we can have models to help predict who is at risk and give them time to mitigate, then that's a huge driver. And so we really focus on what's gonna move the needle in the industry, uh-huh. Definitely. But I think what Fred was saying is very right. When we were doing our own reflection of like, what should we be focusing on? There was a bunch of things internally, right? Like internal Alaya Care efficiencies. And one of the big things were things like Zendesk, right? And we're like, well, geez, it would be so great if we could have a little AI assistant where we could say, okay, what has been asked before in Zendesk and bring up all that. And then we also said to ourselves, wait a minute, we shouldn't be bothering with this. Zendesk is going to do it, right? Let them do it and we'll just use it because it's just going to be in the platform, right? So all that type of stuff, like he's totally right. Let's not try to compete with those who that's their core business. And just like the open AIs and all, they're going to come out, they have APIs for these type of things. So let's use those. But the ones where we really have, and that is our competitive advantage, where we have the data, where we have that specific context, that's really where we can move the needle.
Yeah. So it's nice to be reminded that at the end of the day, it's easy to get attracted and excited by all of this new technology, but it still comes back to what's going to impact the experience for users. What does the competitive landscape look like? And so you shouldn't necessarily try to find a solution for a new technology. You should start with the end user in mind, which is
the proverbial, looking for a problem type of thing. Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, one of the great advantages of POC is that because they can be done so quickly and they're so interactive, by nature, at least it's an AI POC. It's a great way to engage the product, marketing, and sales team, which normally, you know, I mean, you always have a conversation with them when you're developing an AI product, but it's not as visceral as actually putting them in front of a Gen AI POCs and say, hey, how do you think the customers? It goes back to what Naomi's saying, engage with your customers if you can. And even if you cannot, or if you want to do something faster, just internally, you can actually have this conversation with folks who are actually closer to the customers. And it's valuable. It's an interaction that doesn't often happen in large company between AI and maybe doesn't happen as much as.
I was surprised when we talked, you mentioned how quick you're able to spin up POCs, which probably creates that dynamic, right? Where there's not a lot of time between discovery and people actually being able to get output from it where they can provide feedback. So I think that's really an exciting part of, like you said, how the technology empowers teams to build MVPs or POCs quickly. And so once you're past the POC stage, how do you figure out what should go into production and what are some of the kind of pitfalls or traps or unknowns that people should think about when they're going from one stage to the other stage? Go for it, Naomi.
Sure. Okay. I think just to finish off the quickness of the POCs with Gen AI too, you're right, because I know there's been even some ideas that we've really fallen in love with. Like, we're like, this is so awesome. Our customers are going to love it. And then you kind of present it to them and they're like, you know, and it's so disappointing, but it's good to be able to fail fast there, because you could actually really show it to them. And then they're like, well, that's not as powerful as something else. So that's really useful. I think there's a few things that we see once we've put things into production that are really important to keep in mind. So one of them is data contracts. So you have to remember that your models are trained on X amount of data, and hope that when you put them into production, those same pipelines represent the data that has been trained on. But your customers aren't necessarily, they don't think of you all the time that, oh, if I'm going to change this process, I wonder how that's going to affect the downstream pipeline that's feeding the machine learning models. So you have to make sure that they understand that, right? Because we have seen that where all of a sudden you're monitoring and you see there's some weird data drift, or all of a sudden you're seeing there's some data points that aren't being captured anymore. And then they're like, oh yeah, by the way, we don't capture that anymore. We've now moved to something else. And you're like, oh, okay, that's really going to affect the model, right? So they're trying to make them conscious. So we do actually kind of write up data contracts. Like, this is what's going in. This is what we've agreed on. This is cadence. And if there's any changes, let us know, which, you know, sometimes it's that's not a good thing either, because they're like, by the way, we're about to change a form and do this. Okay, now we have to. So those type of things are hard. And then how do you scale that? Because sometimes it's not all the same, but that's very important because, again, the machine learning, it's a living, breathing thing. So if the inputs change, then it's going to change as well. So I think that's one. I already touched on explainability, but I can't emphasize that enough, especially for healthcare, how much it has to be clear, not suspicious. They really have to feel comfortable in order for them to really start using it on a daily basis. So making that as clear as you can. And we've used techniques mostly in UX by, for example, if we want to see why is a patient higher risk today than yesterday, we put little icons to show maybe there was a fall, maybe there was increase in medications, maybe there was a new diagnosis that was put in. So we give them little indications and then we allow them to go back 28 days to see what has happened so they can see a longitudinal view and kind of see how things were progressing. So we try and give them as much information so that they trust it and they start to trust the model. And I think the last thing that you really have to keep in mind is safety. So we know there's a lot of talk about safety and there's many different aspects of safety in terms of introducing bias in your data or in your models. There's hallucinations, there's all that. But there's just plain old data safety, making sure if you are using proprietary models, how is your data? How are you communicating with these models? So this was one of the reasons why we chose to use a managed service, so that at least our data is within our kind of secure organization, within, for us, AWS, because there is always risk if you're sending out data to different APIs. For us, we have to be very careful in terms of having any health data. So that whole safety aspect, definitely when you're going into production. And then cost is the last one that I wanted to mention. It's a little bit hard to gauge these days because a lot of the providers are changing a lot as you go along as well. but making sure, where does it make sense to host internally smaller models? Where does it make sense to maybe have your own bigger model, depending on what's going to be the type of traffic? If you're just doing demoware, it's not going to be as expensive to use outside services, but maybe it makes more sense to host them internally. What are your latency needs? What are your safety needs? So you have to take that all into consideration when you're actually choosing how to actually put this into production.
Amazing. Super practical feedback. Fred, anything you want to build on top of that? I know we've talked a lot about AI and ethics, which Naomi touched on. Anything before we jump into that on the POC to production side?
Sure. So, I mean, everything that Naomi said is like gold standard. So we listen to her. I hope she had her recording. For large company, what we found is that we needed to have a bigger picture in mind when we were actually thinking about the POC and putting that in production. And the reason is this, like your company, 10,000, 15,000 employees, every department is looking at building products now or Gen AI models, et cetera. And you have to make sure that you actually enable the company to scale securely. Like you need customers to have a consistent experience. You cannot have five different assistants in different part of the product that have different actually look and feel, way to interact with you, way to ask a question, et cetera. That's a branding issue, like the voice of the customer, the voice of the agent. So for example, Ukiji represented a brand and we want to make sure that that brand was represented in the way the assistant talked to you. All of what I'm talking about is things that has been public already. We've thought a lot about what Ukiji has done. We presented at Google Next last year. We presented at Google Next this year. Again, we really betting a lot on generative AI. So there's a lot of learning there. But also like reusability of asset, like one vector database with one configuration for everybody, one ways of doing right use cases. Again, because cost, security, consistency, and scale, right? So we actually created a generative AI platform on top of Vertex to help our internal team develop their own generative AI experience. So you're not a gatekeeper, you're an enabler. So I think, and again, it's applicable for larger companies that decide that they want to transform themselves using AI. But I thought that was a very interesting way of actually going faster. Mm-hmm. Then it allows you to be less model agnostic because Naomi is entirely right. But those models change all the time. Eventually, I believe that most companies will have their own trained LLM based on fine-tuning on their own data, most likely something like open source. It will make sense for a lot of companies, right? So you want to make sure that you can actually make these choices. AI governance for us, we had a very close collaboration with our legal team. And before we actually went into production, we actually sat down with them. Like HCM is not as regulated as healthcare, but it's being determined one of the high-risk industries by the European new sets of AI laws. It's really important that you do things fairly, obviously considering the impact you can have on people's lives. So lots of close collaboration, looking at the impact, looking at the possibility of things going wrong, et cetera. So that's really the two things. And then one of the things that you always have to do, especially with the teams, the product teams that don't necessarily fully grasp AI and the plus and minus of it, have success metric. Talk about them before you start the project. Again, of POC, we want to put this in production. Okay, what does success look like from an adoption perspective, but also from an accuracy perspective, et cetera, and work to make sure that you actually track that. And one of the things I found it throughout my life as a consultant in AI, make sure you have the time and resource to create ML ops, feedback loops, monitoring grid, et cetera. A lot of people think that deploying AI is just actually building the model and giving it to the front end, and you don't put enough time or resources on your plans. That way it works in large company. If you don't have the budget, if you don't have the time allocated, it's not going to happen. And then that model is flying blind.
Great insight. And so we're about 15 minutes left to the end of the panel. Thank you for sharing all of your feedback. We'll jump into some of the Q&A. We have a couple of questions already. Feel free to ask some more. We'll try to get to a few of them. And so in terms of, as you can see, measuring financial costs of a POC and trying to estimate ROI, how do you approach that?
You want to take this?
I have an opinion. It's a bit of an art, I would say, right now. It's definitely not science. It's not different than any other project that you're really trying to estimate. I'd say the difference that I find is just the constantly moving goalposts. So you could, from week to week, you could be going with a better model that's actually cheaper and is cheaper to deploy. And then something better comes along. So you have to be nimble. But so I think on the actual cost side, you just have to give a margin of error. But in general, you can pretty much guarantee that the costs are going to go down. So I think right now you have to see, what is it today? What is the throughput going to be? And you try and make some sort of an estimate. In terms of the ROI, that's a little bit trickier, because it really depends if you're putting this in production for efficiency. Because again, efficiency can always be measured in either actual less salaries, but it can be measured in productivity. I think for us, we look at, if we're putting these things in and selling them as premium products, then it's how much can we sell this for? And that's how we put the ROI in. But there always has to be a good use case on what is really the repetitive task that you are freeing them up to do. So I'd say it's pretty much the same as your regular estimating of POCs, but you have to kind of update it more often than not because of the moving goalposts.
Yeah, I think as Fred mentioned, communication to stakeholders about that reality is probably important, because it's not common in non-AI projects for the costs to change that dramatically. And so making that aware for executives and other stakeholders is important.
I mean, the cost of POC leveraging the AI solution significantly lower than traditional ML. Mostly because it's a lot easier to actually get going with a quick POC versus like collecting the data, doing some ETL, looking at different models that could actually create good results, etc. However, our experience has been that the end cost of deploying a solution is about the same. It's a lot quicker to do an AI POC, but it's actually the delta between the POC and the production is much higher than the delta between a traditional ML POC and production. So that's the part where people are sometimes surprised, like to actually look at the total cost, especially when you include creating the feedback loop, the automated monitoring, et cetera, which I think is necessary in this day and age.
Amazing. Stefan asked a question about some examples of, of Gen AI, I believe, specific projects in the last year that you've seen that are having impact on enterprise. I think, Naomi, you talked about how at AliaCare, because of the need for transparency and communicating what's actually happening behind the scenes, it sounds like you're using more deterministic models. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but any examples maybe in the industry or broadly that you're hearing about that are having impact?
Yeah, so there's a few questions in there, but you're right. I'm thinking where we're doing a lot of experimentation right now is really in the conversational part. So I would say in the part where summarize this, translate this, those are working quite well, which is really nice, because some of them are very, very powerful. And even extracting the important information. Like one example I'll give you is the nursing notes, whereas before, literally a clinical supervisor has to read through all of those. Like at the end of the day, they never get to. So they'll maybe do it like once a week. But here we've created a product that automatically reads all the notes, pulls out what is the important things and flags them if it has to be looked at right away. So they can do that. It'll be done like the same day. And that's a huge time saver. And can actually help mitigate risk. So those type of things work out well. I'd say where it's the conversational part that is a little harder to tame. So, and what we're finding is there's a real difference. If you can get it, the actual assistant very close to the context in which the questions are being asked, then it helps a lot. And if you can use some RAG as well to be able to narrow down where it is they should be fetching the answers, that helps as well. But when there's too much context, when you can just have almost like a clippy type of thing where you can ask anything about anything, then it's a lot of tokens and a lot of question and answer internally for it to even narrow down what is your question about. So I think the ones that work, so I have like one in mind where there was one demo that I saw, is a company called Octopus, and they do like their customer service type of conversational AI works really well because it's on a very specific set of data for quite narrow cases. Those work quite well. When you start to, for it to be multi-context, that's where I find you really need those guardrails. And that's not quite a solved problem. And maybe you have some other examples off the top.
So I think if I think of two areas where Gen AI is, so the world where it's significant, like we can discuss that, but where I think we're going to see some real, I mean, customer services and not as a replacement of agent hallucination problems are well known, not resolved, like normally said, et cetera. But to actually notify the life of the agent, normally like you have a lot of transfer between tier one, tier two, tier three. So summarizing past conversation, summarizing the context of the customer's past interaction with customer service, what product he has, et cetera, and providing, leveraging RAG to actually suggest areas of document, customer service documentation where that could solve the problems. This could actually really help agent being much more effective and actually make their job much more enjoyable. So this is one area where I think I've seen product that are very interesting, but the implementation of this product at scale will take time because change management and process, right? 80% of that work. But I think this is one area where Gen AI is going to make its mark. And then the other one is marketing, everything like creation of documents, the generation of IDs, et cetera. Obviously that has been well documented where, so this is an area where significant impact. Those are the two. I'm a huge fan of Copilot. Especially developing plugins for Copilot. If you're a Microsoft company, I'm not doing Microsoft advertising here. I have no Microsoft stock, I think. But I've seen some preview of what they're working on, and it's very exciting. Will it make sense for everybody in the company? No, not right now. And I think that the biggest value is developing plugins that are specific from your company, but leveraging the Microsoft graph or the graph of your data that Microsoft has on you. So this can actually create enormous efficiency in finding information or communicating information within a company, but it's going to take some time before it reaches scale within a company.
So I hear the theme of summarization being really powerful with Gen AI. And then the other thing I hear is the human in the loop, right? It's still most powerful by empowering the agent or the human. Versus replacing the human, which is great to hear. So we're almost up on time. I don't know if we have time to squeeze in another question, but if folks wanted to follow what you guys are working on, Robin, I know I kind of set you off on that. Do we want to try to squeeze this one in quickly in a couple of seconds? So
how do you navigate the challenges? My initial reaction is part of the question, how do you navigate the challenges of managing expectations, your board or client while driving results? I feel like it's the board is usually the one who they keep pushing, even though you're telling them the results aren't there yet. And it's like, I know everyone wants to be the first with the best result. But I think navigating the challenges and expectations, I think with clients, that's why I like to do this kind of rapid prototyping. Because you can literally put it into their hands and everyone can see for themselves. So I do think the best way to manage expectations, and sometimes you're giving them, they're disappointed because it's not living up to the hype, right? And so I think you have to manage and make sure it's not the team, we've actually had to be, listen, there's papers that are still, this is not a solved problem. There's papers that are still thinking about this. And I think because the GPTs made everything, it's so nicely packaged as a product for consumers, it makes you feel that everything is solved, that it's really here to stay. Why can't you just put it into our processes and have it work all the time as nicely as GPT? So I think that's more the challenge, is that once you take it out of just this general generation about anything, it's not quite as simple. And it's important, right? Like you can't make mistakes. And I think that's what you have to share with them.
Yeah. I think like now we say, so you're going to have, I'm sure the person who's asking that has pressure from board or boss to ideally develop something that might not be quite ready. Include the product team, but your technical team, include the product team, act closer to the customers, into the creation of the POCs, and be strict about defining success metric. So one of the things I used to say internally is, okay, we're going to create a Gen AI use case. How right do you want to be? And then they were like, What do you mean, all right? Sometimes the answer is kind of great. Like, often you want to be right. And then when you're wrong, how wrong can you afford to be? This is those three questions and having the conversation and starting to put actually some percentage on it was actually a great way for people to realize, okay, might not work all the time. And then you do this test. We had, obviously, we work on 2 weeks spring, and then we were measuring the result of every spring. And then we had our evaluation framework. We started at the beginning. So part of it is automated. Part of it is manual. Like, look at the answers. They send these, like, people from customer teams or the sales team might actually look at the answers and, like, read them. And then you actually see that you're making progress, but you also see that there's some problem that you don't solve. And then after that, management is aware, like, okay, maybe there's too much of an exposure here, so we don't launch it. Maybe we rethink the way we use that technology. Mm-hmm. I think that's one way. We cannot say no. And education is always great, but some people don't necessarily want to learn, or they don't have the time, or maybe not enough base. So just include them in the process, have metric, and I think you will take care of itself.
Amazing. Super helpful. So we're right up on noon Eastern time. Thank you so much, Naomi and Fred, for joining us. Really quickly, if people want to follow what you're working on, get updates on AlayaCare. And Fred, I know you're working on some education on ethics in AI. So where could we follow both of you?
Yeah, LinkedIn.
Probably.
We'll share that with the group. Thank you again so much. Robin, thank you for organizing, and thank you everybody for joining. It was really great, and hope we can do it again.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for your questions. Thank you.
Having us. Bye-bye.
Hey, have a great day.
We'd like to thank all of you for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on your preferred listening service. Stay connected with us on LinkedIn and visit our website, mission.dev, for more information on our network and platform. See you next episode.